Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Emerging Enterprise Radio, featuring high growth companies and their trusted advisors.
Welcome to another episode of Emerging Enterprises. I'm your producer, Kevin Finn, and as usual, I have Van Baird in the studio with me. Welcome, Van.
Good to see you, buddy.
So you've been geeking out about this show for such a long time. I got a text last night, like 2 a.m., be like, dude, Hannah Bridges coming on the show tomorrow. I'm so excited. I can't sleep. It was crazy.
He's only halfway kidding.
So you got pretty excited.
Yeah.
You made fun of me trying to grow a beard.
You do need to stand a little closer to your razor. That's
exactly.
All I'm saying.
I completely agree. I woke up this morning. I was like, I need to go shave. And I was like, I have 10 more minutes of sleep. That sounds better.
It's too long. It actually take longer to shave than not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
anytime you choose not to shave would take. Anyway. So, yeah, I'm thrilled to have our guest in the studio because I feel like I am her official welcome wagon, and this is the first time I think we've given you, well, Hive was a stage-ish, but hopefully the number of people we reach today will be even more than that. So I get to introduce the city of Atlanta to Hannah Brencher. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. You are like my welcoming committee.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So there is a company that you founded that will unfold called More Love Letters. The world needs more love letters. And so I want you to be able to tell that story, but I just, from an interviewing standpoint, we've got an hour to spend together.
Yes.
And so, we want to cover a few different areas, and I thought just to get it right out of the way, so we don't have to spend a lot of time on him, is can we define the relationship you have with Aaron Tuning at this point? Mr. Atlanta himself, Aaron Tuning, and Hannah Brencher. If you wish to define that relationship now, we can continue to delve into that.
All I'm going to say is that it seems like a lot of the Bachelor and Bachelorettes come out of Atlanta these days. So if Aaron Tuning's on the show, I'll be the first one to audition.
You'll be the first one out of the limo?
Multiple roses.
Okay.
Multiple roses for Aaron
Tuning.
That's
a good definition.
To love that doesn't die.
That is a good definition of that relationship. So shout out to Aaron. So you're...
Face palm.
Yeah, for sure. So you brought your show to the South. You brought your talents to Atlanta from the Northeast, and you've lived all over. You grew up where?
I grew up in Connecticut.
Right. Greenwich?
North Haven, Connecticut.
North Haven, Connecticut. So you lived your entire life there.
Yep, I lived in North Haven. I lived in Massachusetts, right near Boston. And then I lived in New York City, and then I came back to Connecticut, specifically in New Haven, Connecticut, by Yale.
Okay. All right. So that's where your formative years were from.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty normal family.
Yep. Great family.
And at the ripe old age of how old did you decide to go and work at the UN?
I was 21 at the time.
21 at the time.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You took a very low paying job.
Yeah. It was a year of service. So you actually agree that you will make no money for the entire year. You will live off of a $25 a week stipend.
In the city of New York.
Yes. Living in the Bronx and then working in Manhattan.
That's really impressive.
Yeah. Well, you should know. You've been there. Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
But you can't even live off dollar cheeseburgers for that much.
Well, they did. I mean, they did make sure that we had housing. Like, we lived in an immigration center. So that in itself was a challenge. But they were just asking that for your own personal expenses, no more than $25.
Okay. So because, you know, it's going to help lay the foundation. I don't think More Love Letters would have started had you not been in that role. But what was it? Because we interview a lot of people in your age range, and we don't use the millennial tag just for what it tends to be taken as, but just to define a demographic. So what was it coming out of college that you decided that was what you wanted to spend a year doing? What was it in your heart, in your life?
You know, I always wanted to do something, I guess, do something that mattered. And wanted to help people. But after a while, it seems like you say that and people are like, yeah, we all want to help somebody.
Sure.
Like, you can't just say, like, what are you going to do after college? Help people.
Right.
Like, you can't do that. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. Like, I knew I wanted to write and I knew that I like had a calling for writing. But at the same time, that's not practical either, where it's like you say you want to write and somebody's like, cool, you want to eat ramen noodles and write the next Harry Potter in your basement. That sounds really responsible.
Right.
So I was like, really, I felt the pressure of everybody just saying, like, what's next after college? What's next? And so I knew that there was a thing called the service year, that instead of doing the Peace Corps, which is 2 years, I could do 1 year of service and it could be domestic service in the country, learning more about the poverty in the U.S.
Right.
And I figured, once I actually walk out into the world, get a salary, get a well-paying job, it's going to be really hard to walk away and do something like this. So maybe before I've ever felt what a salary feels like, I should just do a year of nothing and really challenge myself in that capacity. And I mean, I grew up with like basically all of the stuff from the UN, all the posters and all of those things were like all around my bedrooms growing up as a child. So like I knew that if I could go to the UN, if I could work through the UN, I would do that.
Okay, let's go there. Okay. Because I know of no one that had bedroom pictures of the UN.
Like Justin Bieber. But.
So what was it such so early on that you knew you wanted to be in a service role?
I have always loved people beyond what I can even comprehend. Like I would be the one that if there was some sort of like commercial or something in the movie theaters for children that were hungry, my mom had to take me out of the theater because I felt it too much. Like I just always this empathy that I could not understand. And I mean, when you get older and you realize that this thing is actually called human rights and that there's so many people that don't have education or they don't have access to clean water or these kinds of huge issues, I just became fascinated with this place that exists in our country where world leaders come together and they actually sit down and think, in an ideal world, like how could we make things better? How could we actually work together instead of just figuring out how we want to fight one another?
Right.
And so I really was like, I need to see what's going on there. I need to be involved.
So that's really, really interesting because nobody I know of thinks that way. But you also had the proximity of the UN. You had you knew what they were about. And in theory, that is the way we should be working.
I like grew up like memorizing like the UN Declaration on the Rights of the Child
by
Eglantine Jebb, who started Save the Children. Sorry.
There you go. Can you recite it?
I'm not going to recite it.
Put you on the spot. Okay, so you're going to New York to live off $25 a week.
Yeah.
Expectations going in were 1 to 10 being like 10, I'm changing the world. 1, I'm a crazy person. Your expectations going in were where?
I was like a 14.
Okay.
I was like, I've always wanted to live in New York City. This is amazing. And like, New York City is not the place you just show up in. I know people do that, but it's like people go
but
to
you
New-
did.
I did. Well, I did, but I also knew, okay, I have a home. So like I've got an apartment at least because most people like out of college are like,
I've
okay.
I've got a guitar and a dream.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you will not meet the person in New York City that's like, I just came here on accident. Like I picked a spot on the map and was like, but the people are nice and the rent is cheap. Like that's not New York City.
No.
Like, and I saw this opportunity to go to New York City and like be a magazine editor and like be a writer and like Sex and the City. Like that was like what I thought I was going to do. And then at the same time, I was like, I'm going to help people. I'm going to change the world. It's going to be great. And like, maybe I was too idealistic, but like my expectations were high.
Okay. All right. So you get there. How many months in before those expectations start going south?
Oh gosh, the first week.
Okay.
Like
okay.
Honeymoon period over.
Gotcha.
Like, I mean, it's like that first week you're like, yeah, I'm in Central Park. This is great. This is wonderful. And life just hit me in the face. Mm. Like I realized like living in the Bronx, I knew nothing. I understood nothing.
Right.
And to this day, it still tears me up because you walk into a situation and you think, I'm going to help people and I'm going to help my community. And I walked in and I realized like a week into it, like they're going to help me. I have no right saying I even get to help this sort of poverty, that I even understand this sort of poverty, because working at the UN, you got a pretty safe distance between what was going on in other major countries and like what's actually happening here. Mm-hmm. When I would take the train back into the Bronx, I had to face the fact that my neighbors were homeless and some of the people I talked to on a daily basis that just wanted to love me were homeless and had nothing to give me. And yet I had thought I'd walk in and I would help people. And that was what I realized, like, wow, I have a lot to learn. I have a lot to grow up with. And especially for the fact that I remember one day, like my roommate and I, we were walking around the Bronx and we were looking for like a crossbody bag because like people would come by and like snip your bag and like run with it. But so we were looking for this bag and we were talking and I just was like, I don't know, like, what is the separation? Like, what is the difference between, like, us and our neighbors? And she was like, it's education. Like, that's the difference is you got to sit in a desk for 4 years and get this education because your parents had enough credit to get those loans.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why the gap is so wide. And so that was the guilt I carried around with me every single day for the fact that, like, when this year was over, I would get to pick up, leave, go find a job because mm-hmm. I had an education to get the job. And even doing this year of service looked good on my resume, you know, having the UN on the resume looked great. And that like rubbed against me like sandpaper. Like, why do I feel like I'm playing pretend with what other people would say is a reality?
Yeah. Because, and we'll touch on this later, but you spoke on that at your first event here in Atlanta at Hive. With that little 5-minute video that kind of touches you in the moment versus the stories that change your life.
Yeah.
And so just the experience of being there and seeing the dichotomy, it's almost a burden. Well, it was for you.
Oh, it wrecked me. The dichotomy wrecked me, especially because, you know, you'd live in the Bronx and you'd get all dressed up to walk over to the UN and like you'd walk down the street and people would look at you like, what are you doing here, you know, and get on the train and go into Manhattan and you would watch the demographic on the train just shift.
Right.
And you knew a lot of the people you were sitting next to, the reason they were on the train is to go clean the offices you were going to sit inside of. And then you would experience it coming back. And I mean, Jonathan Kozol, who is like a famous sociologist, he wrote about that actual train ride on the 4 train and how that was the train that I used and just how like you could just watch the people switch over. And I couldn't handle it. Like I could not handle it. I would cry every day on that train ride because I felt so small, so insignificant, like it couldn't actually help anybody.
Where did this birth inside of you? Because that's an old soul. It doesn't define it the right way. The empathy level obviously is off the charts. What in your life growing up gave you that level of empathy? Any idea?
I mean, my mom always was like, I don't know where you come from. I'm not really sure. Because like as a little girl, I just wanted to be left alone to create things and create my own space. But my mother raised me specifically on the teachings of Mother Teresa. So she gave me a real person to look at that was like a real life human being. And Mother Teresa was always at my tea parties growing up. And my mom, from a very young age, just was taking me to soup kitchens. And every time I would go into New York City, like I remember it so clearly, to take a dance class, she would give me 3 sandwiches wrapped in tinfoil. And she told me, you know, the people are hungry, give them the sandwiches. And so I didn't understand poverty. I didn't understand why somebody was hungry. But I would walk up to homeless people and give them peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and was never like, this is weird or this is strange. So that's probably my mother.
It was just in you then. Okay. So mom had a lot to do with that.
Mom had a lot to do with it. Mom's a lover.
Okay. So you got into New York what month?
I got in August.
Okay. So the subway ride was 3 months later.
Yeah. October.
Not even 3 months.
Yeah.
Okay, so take us through that, because I love the story, and you've told it a million times, but so you see a woman, and you want desperately to speak to her.
Yeah.
You just wanted eye contact.
Yeah, I just wanted her to look at me. And I don't know why. I mean, I'd ridden the train countless amounts of time, and I'm not a New Yorker in the sense of real New Yorkers don't look at anybody like when they're on the train. Like, they don't look around.
That's so
it's
true.
Like, I will cut you if you look in my direction. Okay. That's basically it, and I couldn't help but watch people. I would watch the people fighting on the subways. I would watch the homeless man that was giving this speech for the 52nd time that day and no one looked up. And I just couldn't help but just watch people because especially in New York City, people are fascinating, like down to the socks that they're wearing.
Right.
I mean, I would write about all these people, but this one time I was on the train and I was going home and I remember this woman pulling out from the subway and I remember she was wearing this bright red cap and she had wisps of gray hair coming out from underneath the cap. And for some reason, like, I just could not take my eyes off of this woman. She was older. She had a slump to her shoulder. She just looked torn down and she just looked broken. And she sat right across from me. She tucked her head against the wall and she didn't look up. And I mean, I know that because like I looked at her for that entire train ride, just wanting her to say something to me. And like, I remember in the moment kind of bullying myself because my mother would have been the person to go and say something to her. My mother would have talked to her. My mother talked to everyone. She just didn't see any kinds of barriers or boundaries. And I guess I've grown to be that outgoing of a person, but I wasn't back then. And so for reasons like I can't even explain, I pulled out a notebook and I just started to write her a letter. Yeah.
Okay. So on the train?
On the train. Yeah.
Okay. So you're right, and you finished it on the train.
I finished it on the train, and she was gone. She left the train. I didn't even notice she left the train.
Okay, because we're going to let you finish, but I've always wanted to ask you this question. Like, what would you say to her now?
What would I say to her now?
Well, like you said, you wouldn't, not
to put you on the spot or anything.
No. But like, you said your mom would have walked over into the, and you've grown, you're a different person.
Yeah.
If Hannah Brinter today sees that lady on the subway, what would you have gone over and said that wasn't in the letter?
I mean, I think I could have just started a simple conversation with her. You know, it's something as simple as like, how was your day? And we look at that and we're like, oh, no, no, this is my bubble and this is my box. And yet any person that's asked me that on a train in New York City or in a Target in Atlanta, wherever, I've been thankful. And it makes you feel a little less lonely that somebody really cares how you're doing.
That's and that's kind of the moment that happened for you, is that you found a way to let people know they're important.
I found a way to talk to everybody in New York City without them even knowing I was talking to them.
All right. So where'd you leave the letter?
So I wrote that letter and then I wrote another letter until I filled a notebook.
Yeah. On the train.
It started in the train, and then I was like, I love writing these letters. So I just started picking people out, writing to them. And like, they didn't know that I was writing to them.
Right.
But like, I did that until I filled an entire notebook. And there was another day on the train where I was just like, you know what? Like, I don't need these letters. I'm never going to read them again. Like, I don't know what to do with them. So I literally just ripped one out, folded it up, and I wrote on the front of the letter, if you find this letter, it's for you. And then I remember, like, I felt like I just robbed a bank or something. Like
adrenaline rush, everything.
Yeah, like, I felt like a, like, I don't know. And I took the letter, and I put it behind my back, and I sat the whole train ride with the letter behind my back, being like, okay, we get to Grand Central. I'm going to walk as fast as I can out of here so nobody could be like, you left something behind.
Right.
You know, it's New York, so they probably wouldn't have said anything anyway. But so I, like, sat there that whole train ride, and, like, the little MTA woman who was like my best friend at the time, I thought we were best friends even though she wasn't a real person, but I loved hearing her voice because it was familiar. She was like, this is Grand Central, 42nd Street.
You're like, yes.
And then the man comes in and he's like, stand clear of the closing doors, please. And like, I bolted and like left the letter there and just was like, that was sort of fun. So then I left it in a coffee shop. I started tucking them into the delegate seats at the UN, like everywhere.
And obviously the website is not up yet, so you don't have any kind of way of people.
No,
yet,
I
that
didn't.
Came later. Okay,
I didn't want people to find me. Okay. I think, I mean, I was so insecure at that point that I was like, if people find out that I'm the one that wrote the letter, they're like, well, that's just sad. Like, and so I kind of liked that I was getting to, like, be honest, talk about how I felt, and talk about how I was struggling, and then just like leave pieces of myself around New York City.
Yeah, do you remember any of those letters? What you said?
I remember, I mean, it was a lot of, it was a mixture, because I think people think love letters and they think encouragement and you're doing great and keep going. And I wouldn't say that those were the letters that I wrote. Like, I wrote more so about like, why am I struggling? And like, why can't I hold it together? Mm-hmm. And like, have you ever wanted to be a different person? Like, have you ever wanted to just like reach out to somebody and talk to somebody and hey, like, maybe you don't know it, but you are worth something. And I'm just saying that because I wish I said that more to the people in my own life, you know? And I talked a lot about intention and presence and the fact that I felt like I was living in a city where everybody was so disconnected. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that's not just New York City, that's everywhere.
Sure.
And that disconnect was something that I have always been super aware of. Like when social media started, like I love social media, but I also was like, we're getting distant from one another.
Yep.
We're not fully here right now. And if you get on a subway and you realize everyone is plugged into their phones and their books and whatever they have right in front of them, it's like you just miss the chance to like meet dozens of people, hear their stories, and like form relationships.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen you in a crowd. Like, you live that. That's not just for the company.
Yeah.
Right. So that there was a change. So at what letter and how many days into that before you said on your website, here's what I'm doing?
So I had written, I would say it was about like 2 weeks worth of letters that I was like, okay, I'm going to go and I'm just going to blog about it. And like, it wasn't anything where I thought I'm going to reveal to the world what I'm doing. You know,
okay.
It was, I just wanted to write specifically about the fact that we don't write these kinds of letters. And I remember writing about like Nicholas Sparks and like how there was a reason why his books are bestsellers, because he always writes about love letters. But I specifically wrote about a professor who taught me when I was in college, and she taught an African-American text literature course. And I remember she taught just like with this belief that like books can just straight up mangle you. Like they can just like change you if you let them. And I remember one day that she was like standing in front of the class, and she started to tell us this story about how she and her husband had fallen in love at this point where like there was just going to be this like great distance between them.
Mm.
And like she had basically said she was never going to fall in love with somebody again. She didn't want to marry anybody. And like her best friend at the start of summer vacation in college like said, I'm going to write to you when I get home. And she was sort of like, yeah, I'm sure you'll write to me. And 3 days later, a letter showed up and another letter showed up. And like every single day that summer vacation, he wrote her a letter.
Mm.
And they fell in love with letter writing. And
wow.
I think the thing that just got me so much was her talking about the fact that, like, I mean, the year was 1971. Mm-hmm. She was like, we couldn't call one another, and mm-hmm. we couldn't necessarily, like, send a text mm-hmm. or a tweet or anything. And you couldn't go onto Google and stalk somebody before you decided if you actually wanted to read that letter, you right. know? She was like, you had to put your whole entire self into that letter. Mm-hmm. And then that person had to choose to read it, digest it, and decide if they wanted to move forward. You never knew if you would get a letter back, and you right. might never hear from that person again until those strange high school reunion websites started showing up, you know? Like, and I was enamored with that because then I'm like, here I am, and I get lonely at midnight, and I send a text to somebody, and right. I don't even want to keep that person in my life anymore. And like, how do we get back to this? And so it wasn't like, I want to get back to letter writing. I wanted to get back to that point where, like, I sat across from you and I didn't feel like you were sitting in another room because you were on your phone and you couldn't pay attention to me. And that was what broke my heart, because I think that that is something that maybe you'd call it a first world problem or whatever, but like, that is the problem in our country mm-hmm. today. Like, I know we have bigger issues, but like, no one's present. Like, no mm-hmm. one's here. No one's intentional. No one's connecting. And it breaks my heart. Right. And like, I wrote about that, and I wrote about the fact that, like, gosh, I don't even know what you're going through, that you might need a letter. And if you need a letter, I'll write you one. And I put that simple request out there and really was like, well, I'll write to my mom and I will write to like my best friend or whatever. But right. like, I had blog readers, but I wouldn't say it was anything that I thought it would be an actual substantial, like, this blog post will change my life moment.
Right. But it did.
It did.
So you wake up the next day, how many emails?
I had over 100 requests. Yeah. Stop. Yeah. And
from who? Did you know these people?
Well, so I didn't know these people. But what I also didn't know is that a few weeks earlier, I had sent an email to my favorite author.
This is 2012?
This was 2010.
2010.
Yeah. Okay. It was at the end of 2010. And I had sent an email to my favorite author, Courtney Martin, who writes some great sociological books. I'm a sociology nerd. And I wrote to her and I just was like, could I talk to you for 10 minutes? Like, you're a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer. And your book healed me. And like, I want to write those sorts of books. Like, could we talk on the phone for 10 minutes? And she was like, well, I'm in Brooklyn. So like, we should just meet up and have coffee.
Yeah.
What I didn't know is that she went on my website. She read my stuff. She took that post. She reposted that post. And I had no idea about it. Mm. And so all of her like readers and people that were associated started to request. And that's where the virality of that post started.
Gotcha.
And I remember sitting with her like a few weeks into it, and she was, I won't jump ahead.
No, it's okay. Because the irony is kind of loud here. You wanted to connect, and the reasons you just stated,
yeah.
so people aren't on their phones, but you wouldn't be connecting with people had she not connected you with her people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She saw something in me,
right.
and she was like, I'm going to repost this. This is awesome. She's doing this.
So we'll come back around to this, because I do want to touch on that.
Yeah.
That irony, okay. right? Of what you're accomplishing with cursive on paper mm-hmm. versus the need to still stay in the digital world. So
yeah.
we'll come back around to that. Okay.
Totally.
So you guys have that. You have 100 emails.
Yeah.
And you just started writing.
Yeah. I was kind of like, oh, shoot, what am I going to do? Like, called my mom. And my mom is like, well, you could photocopy a letter and just like send it to everybody. And like, I mean, you look at these stories and I almost was like, it felt like that moment like in The Wizard of Oz where like you go behind the curtain and like you realize it's just this like man or whatever. Right. But like it felt like this moment of like there had been a veil over what was really happening up until that moment where I checked my inbox and it was the saddest stories I've ever had to read. And it was that moment of realizing like I was never alone. I thought that I was alone this whole time and I've never been alone. And now that I know that I'm not alone, I honestly don't know what to do with it. It breaks my heart even more.
Right.
It was stories of like single mothers in Sacramento who like didn't know how to love their own children. And they thought maybe a letter showing up in the mail would help them, or girls being like, I'm at Stanford University and I have everything I'm supposed to have ever wanted and I'm not happy and I don't want to be here. And like a ton of Ivy League girls that were just like, not happy. I have an eating disorder. I'm dealing with depression. I want to kill myself. My friend wants to kill himself. Like craziness, like all in my inbox that I was like, is this even right? Like, and I remember when my mom said, you know, you could just photocopy a letter. I was like, yeah, I could. But like, how much courage does it take for somebody to reach out to somebody they don't know? And it's like, hey, nobody in my life is going to show up for me. I need a stranger to show up for me. And like, how would I want somebody to respond? And so I was like, I guess I'm going to write. I'm going to write a lot. And I wrote from that point in October to December, there were 207 letters that I wrote.
All right. So again, without really being published, without being talked about, you just sent these letters.
Yeah.
But you still started leaving letters around New York.
Kept leaving them, yeah. And other people, actually, like, I'd put my address up there because back then it was safe to do it. It's right. Like, here is where I live. I don't do that anymore. I learned my lesson. But I said, you know, if you've ever wanted to leave a love letter around New York City, like, send it to me.
Right.
I will leave it for you. And right. I had dozens of people that were like, I love New York City. I don't know if I'll ever get there. Like, could you leave my love letters? And that was so fun to be like,
oh, wow.
I wonder, like, what coffee shop they'd want me to leave it in. Or, yeah, like, yeah. Where can I leave their letters? So yeah. It's kind of like the Juliet for, like, multiple people, which is really cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. So take me to the 400 number.
Yeah, 400.
How do we get... Take us there.
We went back and forth a lot. So even in meeting with that woman, Courtney, I met her a few weeks into the letter writing, and she had said to me, you know, like, I think you're onto something and I want to pitch you to the press. Like, I want people to know about this. And I told her, no, I said, I don't want to be known for this. I want to do it. Shut up. Get over it. Not, right. I just don't want any attention. I mean, like, the thing is that, like, I was dealing with a depression that really started to riddle me, like, the second I got there. It was almost like there was a lot of stuff I guess I hadn't dealt with before that kind of just came and slammed me in the face when I got to New York City. Right, and right. It was, like, not just, like, the fact that there's poverty around, but that, like, I didn't know that, like, depression was a real thing, that you could just, like, it could just happen one day. And so I literally, like, during that time was waking up to write those letters, was waking up because I knew somebody needed me to reach them that day. And right. That was the only thing that really kept me going in that point of time. And so I told her, no, that I didn't want to be known for it, that I didn't want to try to stand out. And I'd had a lot of girls when I was in New York City, like, just trying. I've always just wanted to be, like, a blessing and, like, show people light and stuff. And I had posted up some quote about, like, it was this quote, like, may God bless me with enough foolishness to believe that I can change the world so that others will go out and do the things they say cannot be done. And I put that up on Facebook
the
one day.
The mantra of the millennials.
Wow. Yes.
Yes.
And I got completely torn apart by girls that had been my friends in college, like, ripped apart, like, completely bullying me, like, coming up with separate statuses, like, riffing off of one another. And then they all just defriended me on Facebook. Like,
wow.
And it was like, I mean, it felt like a slap in the face, but it also felt like that moment when you feel like Facebook is, like, standing in the middle of the cafeteria and everybody's whispering all around you. And I took that as, like, they're right. I'm not actually doing anything. I should just shut up and I should just not try to shine out. So, like, from letter, like, whatever that was, it probably was, like, in the hundreds or, like, in the first 100 letters to 400.
You're just trying to get done.
I was trying to get done. Yeah. I was like, we got to finish this. Like, and I mean, I transitioned into a new job in Connecticut and I had friends again. And like the year was, like, over in that sense of, like, I left New York for a job offer and I got back into a life where I could be comfortably not seeing the hard stuff.
But separately, there's another story that's being written for the Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they interviewed somebody that had read one of your love letters.
Yeah, somebody who had gotten a love letter from me like the week before. And the woman was writing a piece on how we keep the handwritten practice alive via social media.
Yes.
And she reached out to me. And I thought this was some sort of joke because it's like letter 397. And I was stopping at 400. And I was like, okay, I'm stopping this in three letters.
Right.
It's going to be over. Right. And she's like, I want to put you in the paper next week. And I was like, oh my goodness, like, I'm sure you have some really nice readers. I just don't want to write to all of them. Like, I don't want to keep doing this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And that was really the time to be like, okay, is this about me or does this have nothing to do with me? And that's where the creation of More Love Letters came in, is because I really didn't want to have to do with me.
Who's in your life at this point? Who's helping you through this process?
At this point, it was... I mean, it was like my mom who was there and my mom, like, I moved home to take this job, which was a very humbling thing because I was like, I'm never moving home. And then here I am home. And that's what happens when you do your service. You don't walk away with a lot of money. And and honestly, home was the best thing for me, though. Okay. Like, I needed home at that point. And I needed to come back into a space where my mom was just basically telling me, like, no matter what you do, I'm proud of you. Like, I'm proud of you. And I told my mom that I was going to start this love letter writing company. And she was like, you don't want to, though. So why are you going to do it? And I was like, I don't know. Like, people just think I should. Because every person I told about the Wall Street Journal article coming out, they're like, you got to make this something bigger. Like, this is a bigger story than you. Like, you can't kill the story. The story's about to get to the best part.
Mm.
And so it's like my mom was there and all of my friends that were cheerleaders and one of my best friend, Ronnie, who is a complete cynic in the sense of, like, if it was a bad idea, he would have been like, this is a bad idea. Stop it. And
so
I called him intentionally to be like, tell me it's a bad idea. Right. Tell me I can't do this. And he was like, you know, I'm never going to need a love letter, but, like, this is,
people
you got to
do
this. Okay. Yeah.
So you start the site because you started leaving more love letters on your love letters.
Once
so
the site could, launched.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So as people found these letters, they could go and talk about finding the letter.
Yeah, they suddenly had a place to go back to.
Right, which is, I got lost last night on that site
because it was page after page.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So cool.
I mean, it's just page after page after
and
page.
And they're crazy stories. It's not like found a letter. It's like, I was going through this.
It was for them.
Yeah.
It was written for them. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that found it.
Yeah.
So that's at moreloveletters.com. And just read the stories. I mean, if you just need some encouragement on there. So you start leaving these. People start leaving these stories.
Yeah.
And your life has changed. I mean, literally, your life changed forever.
Forever. I mean, it really changed the day that I saw that woman on the train, but it changed so much in the sense of, like, I always knew, like, it always, like, when I was in college, we had this thing, like, we had these retreats, and on the retreats, like, they had this thing called Mandare, which was, like, basically at the end of the retreat, like, you were given a bundle of letters from people all across your life. You didn't know they were writing to you, but it was, like, friends and family and people just being, like, I love you, and I'm here for you, and I'm cheering for you. And I would get massive bundles, like, because I was really involved in student leadership. So it's not like, oh, I'm so cool, I got massive letters. But, like, I would get these massive bundles.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help, but, like, I should have been overjoyed in that moment. But I looked around the room at the people that had only gotten two or three letters. And I kept thinking, like, what if we could get them, like, bundles of letters from people? And so that's where the love letter bundle came out. Because while it's great that love letters get left all over, mm-hmm. like, wherever you live, like, the heart of More Love Letters is these bundles. It's the fact that you go onto the site, you request love letters for family or friends that are going through something.
Yep.
And, like, if your story is chosen, you become the facilitator of what we call a love letter bundle. And so you give us an address, and then you watch your PO box or your mailbox get full of letters for somebody. And you get to love on somebody extravagantly in a way that you couldn't without this massive community. And like, that's like the heart of what we do, is that, like, the stories you hear of people that get, like, hundreds of letters showing up on a day when they think no one's going to remember them, or, like, they're not going to leave anything behind. It's all these people from Indonesia and Australia and the UK and wherever being like, I'm cheering for you. I read your story. Your husband sounds lovely. Like, I'm cheering for you.
Yeah.
It's wild to me.
So you're in every state.
Every state.
You're in how many countries?
53 countries.
53 countries.
Mm-hmm.
And too many college campuses at this point.
Yeah, and they're established, like, they're established chapters on their campuses, which means, like, they are loving on their campus.
All right. So, but the growth came, another kind of moment in this, is that you decided, Miss Introvert, who didn't speak well, to do a TED Talk. You entered a contest.
I know.
How many entries?
Oh, but then it went across 14 countries.
Yeah,
there
were
thousands of entries.
Right.
It was like the homepage of TED for months.
Right. Okay. And you got whittled down to the top.
I was in the top for the US.
Which is how many people?
It was 32 people.
Right. And you didn't ultimately win because there were certain places, and the winner was going to be able to actually go do a TED Talk.
Not in
a
TEDx, Long Beach.
In Long Beach at the TED conference.
Yeah.
And you didn't get chosen.
Didn't get chosen.
But you get a text one day.
Yeah. And it was like one of those things where it's like you literally were like at this audition, and it was in front of past TED speakers. So it was like all your favorite TED Talks were just like sitting there in the audience rating you.
That's
and
crazy.
Like the founder of TED, Chris Anderson, is sitting there front row watching you. And I'm like, he critiqued me the night before. He told me to rewrite half my talk, you know?
Mm.
And at the same time though, like it's funny because I had like anxiety growing up and I was so nervous and fumbling all throughout my dress rehearsal. And I think, like, I just felt like he believed in me. And that might sound weird or whatever, because I'm like,
that's
he sees dozens of people, but he believed in me. And, like, he let me go past my time limit. So I was like, he likes me. And,
you went over 4 minutes.
I went over 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I did, by 38 seconds.
Yep.
But they were so, like, you cannot go over your time limit. You cannot go over your time limit. And I just remember him being like, no, just, like, let her talk.
But I love how that meets up. You just needed one person to believe in you in that moment.
Yeah, and all of TED believed in me. Like, I will never forget the moment of coming off stage where, like, I think everybody was kind of, like, holding their head, like, oh, gosh, she's so nervous. I'm getting mic'd up, and I'm like, I'm going to vomit. I'm sorry. Like, I'll probably vomit on stage.
Because you cannot,
like,
tell at all.
You cannot, no.
No, there's no shaking. There's no...
Well, you can hear the kind of shaking in my voice, but
I couldn't.
I got up there and there was this extreme amount of peace. And I remember walking off the stage and like the girl that like had been like another person for TED, she like took off of her headphones and she was crying and she's like, you did it. And I was like, I did it. And like, that's the thing. Like, giving a TED Talk was wonderful, but that was the best night of my life because for the first time in this whole entire crazy adventure, I felt like I fit in. I felt like no one was looking at me being like, you're crazy for starting this. Everybody was like, you have a good idea and it's worth spreading and we believe in you. And that was like, I was like, I don't ever want this night to end. This is amazing. This is the best night ever. Sure. And like, so yeah, I didn't get chosen.
That was for devastated. The top 32. So you got to go because you're in the top 32.
Yep, top 32. Met the most amazing people.
So you're still in the TED room. You record a video for TED, but it doesn't get chosen.
Doesn't get chosen to go to Long Beach.
To go to Long Beach.
And I get texts from my friends one random day in November and I hadn't been online or anything yet. And they were all like, Hannah, your TED Talk of the day right now. Like you're on TED.com. And I'm like, what? Like, and I like look it up and it's like already at like 30,000 views or something. It like gone up 20 minutes earlier. Like, and I called up the TED content coordinator who had become my friend. And I was like, why is he being my friend if he's rejecting me? You know, like, but so I called him up and was like, is this a joke? Like, what is going on? And he was like, oh, like, congratulations. Like, this is like, you were one of like the favorites within that pile. And we just wanted to put you online. Like, you're a TED speaker now. Like, your life is just going to flip upside down.
If,
like,
if anybody listening, if you go to that, if you pull up Hannah's TED Talk on the TED website, it's got over a million views.
Over a million. It's crazy.
That's insane.
That's like a million people like watching me for some reason, even though my mom's probably watched it like 72 times.
You and your USPS box that you
yeah,
literally.
Yeah, my little, which I think is illegal, but don't tell anybody. But
we won't.
I'm like a spokesperson for them, so never mind. I know, right? Like, you are, I think they probably appreciate
you're
that.
You're a spokesperson for the United States Postal Service. You're on a list of women to watch for the White House.
Yeah.
You and so you're making an inroad into so many lives of people, and you now have a team. Tell me, how in the world did you get this many unbelievable, and they're all female.
They're all female.
I have a bone to pick with you on that.
I was going to mention that.
They are all female.
How did you get these women? And they're all great writers. I mean, the ones that write are amazing. You've got a social media team. You've
got amazing social media team.
How did all this come together?
You know, I immediately, well, while I was at the UN, I did meet a lot of women who were movers and shakers who were doing grassroots things, and they were managing to get people inspired and revved up by something without being able to pay them. You know, so I was with an organization called She'sTheFirst.org, which does girls' education in the developing world. And I was a volunteer for them. And like, you could have paid me $1 million and I would have been like, I don't need the money. I would do this for free just to have this sense of community and this sense of belonging and this sense of I'm doing something that's bigger than me. I'm a part of something that's bigger than me. And so I knew if I built a website and I asked to create a team, people would come, and they did. And we have built an amazing community where, like, in a perfect world, I would love to pay every one of those girls. But, like, when I sit down and I talk with them, they tell me, like, the reason I'm around is, like, one, I love what I do for the organization, but I love the community, and I don't want to walk away from the community. And we also try to really, like, since they're there and we value them, like, pay them through experience. It's like, how can we grow you? How can we mentor you? And it's funny because so many of them have gotten amazing, amazing jobs. Mm-hmm. And half of their job interviews, they come back and they're like, we talked about more love letters the whole time. People are just fascinated by this thing. And so it's, like, become this thing where it's, like, actually, like, we have helped people get jobs and walk into their dream jobs because we're doing something that's creative and innovative that people haven't seen before. And I think we just like are really a tight knit group and really just trying to be like, okay, like let's not do what everybody else does. Let's just make our own rule book and see what happens.
Yeah. And you are. And it's so rewarding. I mean, as a dad, you know, two daughters, you know, I selfishly wanted Sarah Ashley here. And so she's in the studio for the first time today just to be able to hear that story.
Yeah.
You know, just because, I mean, even like what she's doing right now, I told her to be on her phone for different reasons. But I mean, it's just, they're all fighting for that space on the on our digital phones, and you rely on that to help spread your message, and there's a digital component to it.
Totally.
So how are y'all balancing that with, because it's a real, your first talk here in Atlanta was in a room full of entrepreneurs, of people that wanted to connect and collaborate, and you talked specifically about how we can get so caught up in a 5-minute video of somebody getting married and or doing a really cool wedding proposal versus, you know, and how that makes us feel in that brief moment versus, no, here's a story of Mother Teresa who gave away shoes, who wore shoes that didn't fit her, who had gnarled feet that made an impact and changed your whole philosophy on life.
Yeah.
And so you've got letters that you try to do that with, but you need a digital age to do that. How are you guys, is that even a topic of conversation with y'all as far as that kind of tension?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's all run through social media. It's all handwritten letters, but we would not exist without social media. And I knew that from day one. I was surrounded by a lot of movers and shakers that were using social media really well. And I said, this thing has the capacity to change the world if we do it right, you know? And I look at it, though, and I look at social media and I'm like, sure, it's a tweet. Sure, it's like a Vine, but like, the end goal and the long-term goal is always going to be people. Yeah. And people are the ones that are sitting behind the screen. And people are the ones that are hiding behind the screen. Mm. And so that's something we always are talking about on our team is that, like, yeah, we want to strive for excellence. And we want to use social media because it allows us to touch a lot of people in a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. But, like, any email that I get or any tweet that I get or any comment that I get, I know that that is another person on the other side of the screen. And I think about it and I'm just like, you stop everything that you're doing in that moment to empower that person. Because when other people stepped up and they did that for me at the lowest point of my life, it made me feel like I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I really think that that's my long-term goal in everything is like, sure, I've got a task of things to do. I've got a lot of social media to check in on or whatever. But like, if I can stop and send an email to somebody and somebody's going to come back to me like 6 months later and tell me that email made all the difference, like that's the point. Because the point is not about you. The point is about like, how can you grow the other people that are around you so that it's not one leader, that it's like dozens of them and dozens of them. And I think that's what we try to do through our social channels is like, people want to say social media is so scientific, and yeah, it is, but it's humans. Like, it's people that feel deeply and often feel like they're alone and they're insecure and they're comparing each other. And if we can just cut through all of that and create messaging that's like, hey, like, you just need to know that you're here and we see you and you're okay. And like, that is like the biggest thing for our team. It's like, we're constantly saying that line over and over again. It's like, I see you. Like, I see you. Yeah. And that's from my mother, because every time somebody like always says to her, like, it's nice to see you, she always responds and says, and isn't it nice to be seen?
Yeah.
And that's it every day for me. It's just see people, like see people.
Well, and you got a lot of people in Atlanta that loved you, and you decided to move down here last month.
Atlanta.
We wooed you away.
You did.
And the Hive is your reason for coming. I mean, that was your sign.
That was my sign. It was.
But in the middle of all that, you were writing a freaking book.
Yeah, a behemoth of a book. Ooh, yeah.
So tell us about the book.
So the book is a memoir. My first memoir that we sold to Howard Books of Simon & Schuster. So it's actually the Christian branch of Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm. We sold it in October. So I had 4 months to write it. And like, I thought that was like, okay. And it was in the midst of having a packed full speaking engagement season. So I wrote most of it in hotels and in airports.
Yeah.
And I thought like, I can do this. No sweat. 4 months. I can do this. But like, that whole year in New York City and the starting of More Love Letters, I hadn't processed any of it. And so when you write a book, all of a sudden you have to realize like, well, what actually was happening here and what was going on here? And it broke me in two. I mean, I walked out of that book writing season like with a completely different spirit way of looking at life, like completely. And so the memoir is the complete backstory of everything that happened through More Love Letters. It's not the sort of book that's like, and then we made a team and then we did this. It is very much creative nonfiction, just as my book is styled and wrote. But it's this bigger story about how small things make a huge impact. And the story of one girl leaving love letters all over New York City and ultimately stumbling into all the things she's ever looked for.
So it's your voice. When we're going to read that, we're going to hear Hannah.
Yeah, you're going to hear me. Yeah.
Right, because it's so unique. I mean, when I, you know, I had not heard you speak before. I mean, the TED Talk, the 4 minutes. The way that you connect relationally with a room was amazing. And I'm not saying that because you're here on the show or to fluff. You had people laughing out loud.
I'm funny.
One moment, you are hilarious. And I'm not exaggerating. In 15 seconds, they were crying.
Yeah.
Because of the way that you connect emotionally. And so if you can promise me the book's going to sound like that.
Yeah, I'll feel all the feels.
Yeah. Because there's so much that I think, as you're writing the book, was there a moment where you're like, I can't?
Oh, so many.
Yeah.
Over and over again. Every day I can't.
Right.
And I think that that's one of those things where you think writing a book is like, you think it'll be like just like you see on the movies where the people like the coffee is like pouring and there's birds like doing your hair and like all of this crazy stuff. And like, that's not what book writing looks like at all. Like I would sit at home alone, like in my home office for 10 to 12 hours of the day writing about myself, feeling like a narcissist and really like, just like not seeing people and not being able to go out and normally like have those kinds of interactions that I was craving. And it's like, a writer's job, I always say, is to stay back when everybody else moves forward and find a way to find the words for the things you've never been able to say. And that's what I was trying to do, was constantly thinking, maybe this is my story, but like, this isn't about me at all. And for anybody who has ever needed to know that they could do something, that they could do something that mattered, and that it like actually, like the world doesn't revolve around them and that love always wins. Like, right. That's what that book was for. But every single day was like, I can't do this. I can't do this. My story's not good enough. My story's not worth it. Like, and then I think about it and I'm like, well, maybe I need to tell my story for that reason, because there are dozens of people, hundreds upon millions of people in this world that think their story doesn't mean anything. Then why are you here? Your story does mean something. Yeah. And like, if it means I have to write it down for somebody to see that, then like, I'll write it down a million and one times in a million and one languages.
Good. You need to keep doing it because you're a good writer.
I want to do it for the rest of my life.
I found an article that you wrote for Huffington on Maya Angelou.
Yeah, they asked me to write a tribute piece.
That was so touching.
Thank
and
you.
You've read her more than once.
Yes.
It was obvious. Mm-hmm. So, and we actually, there was a quote that we used today. You can't use up creativity. The more you use, the more you have.
The more you have.
And so what I see snowballing is just that. You struggle with the internal, all of your hurts, all your questions, all that. But the more you get creative, like your talks build.
Yeah.
Like on the creativity around, whether it's an analogy, an allegory, or whatever, it just builds. So it comes out in your talking, it comes out in your writing, and you have to keep doing all of those things.
I know. And I maybe writing the book was the most painful process of my life, but I walked out of it being like, I want to do this for the rest of my life. This is the only thing I want to do. I was born for this.
Yes.
I was born for it. I know it.
And good for you. How many people at your age know that's what I was born to do?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 44 and I still think I should be playing basketball somewhere. that's just not what I was born to do.
Yeah. But you should, I think it's a matter of the people that surround you too. I mean, I grew up with my grandmother telling me ever since I was 7 years old, your name will be on spines of books. I will have your name on spines of books. And my mother has always said, it's a matter of when you're a New York Times bestseller. It's not a matter of if. And that made me feel like I could do anything. Yeah. Like,
well, that's that dichotomy you're talking about, just the separation in society. It's the education piece. But it's also, my wife's been in teaching for years, and some kids don't stand a chance.
No, yeah.
They don't have that parent telling them that. They're telling them the complete opposite, if they're talking to them at all. And so the impact that more love letters has on the world, because we're a messed up group of people.
We're all jacked up and beautiful.
Yeah. So the book, the speaking engagements on, those are listed on hannahbrencher.com.
Yes, which is actually going to be switching over to hannahbrenchercreative.com, which we're in the mix of creating right now.
Okay, so hannahbrencher.com will be
hannahbrencher.com will still exist, but we will kind of separate between like what is the blog and what was always just the organic blog and the speaking engagements. So.
Okay. Are you still doing the coffee hours?
The brew sessions.
Yes.
The mentoring sessions. I've scaled back on them, but I am still doing them. But like, it was impossible to do anything else when I was writing the first book. Now I'm moving into the second book. So I'm like, I still do them. It's just not as prevalent. Yeah.
And but for now, they can keep up with that on hannahbrencher.com.
Yep, all on hannahbrencher.com.
So you don't do them all the time. You make them available.
But we have fun mentoring sessions. It's great.
Yeah.
Like, we brew coffee. We get down to it.
The comments are awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, just the people that have gone through those sessions. There's little testimonials on there.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's been cool.
And so you've got a fairly big speaking session coming up in August.
At the Yellow Conference?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the Yellow Conference?
The Yellow Conference is, it's actually their first year as a conference, but it is for women who are creatives. Mm-hmm. And so my friend, Promise Tangeman, who's a graphic designer, she saw me speak at a past conference and wanted me to come. And I just like, it was one of those things where you see the mission of what they're doing and you're like, yes, absolutely. I mean, yellow is my favorite color, but like, I'm down for this because I believe in women that are movers and shakers, and I believe in empowering people. And any chance that I get, I'm like, let's go. Let's roll out, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm really excited for that.
So we got to wrap up, but I do want to touch on just the move to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
You knew a bunch of people.
I did,
already,
yeah.
But who have you connected with here? Because I see what you're talking about online. I see you talk about Atlanta and their brunches.
Yeah.
And I see it, you know, as competitive as you are with the New York brunches, I think we're holding our own.
But you are holding your own. New Yorkers, watch out, because Atlanta does brunch.
Yes, we do. We have nothing else to do with that hour, so we might as well. But who are some people that you're connecting with here that are on that creative bent that you are encouraged by. Because we say on the show all the time, Atlanta is an incubator for those kind of creatives, the social good, the social entrepreneurs. Who are some of those people that you've just leaned on?
Gosh, I feel like I'm meeting endless amounts of them, especially since the Hive. But I mean, the real reason, like, let's be honest, the real reason I moved down here was Aaron Erickson,
yes.
Founder of So Worth Loving, yes. My best friend. We connected over Twitter. So like, Twitter is a real life thing, guys. Because yes. She's the one that was like, come to the South. Like, just come to the South and drink some sweet tea with me. And I'd never been to the South before, and I didn't know I would fall absolutely head over heels in love with Atlanta and spend the next 2 years wrestling with the fact that I knew I needed to move down. But Aaron is an entrepreneur just like myself, and we have really formed a friendship off of just loving on one another, but like doing good together with similar missions. So Aaron is the reason that I had the courage to come down here. My roommate Morgan Blake is another amazing creative photographer in the industry of Atlanta, very well respected, and I find it an honor just to live with her. Jeff Shinabarger, who I'm working out of Plywood People, and he just challenges me every single day. And I mean, like, I walk away challenged, and I feel like I'm kind of being gutted a little bit, but like, I'm growing as a leader, which was the big reason to move to Atlanta anyway, you know?
You know, there's movies where we try and harness continual energy, you know, people fighting over, you know, how can we get... you know, that's what the whole Batman movies were about. And I mean, this energy, this orb, all the, if we could just plug into the Plywood building, the amount of energy in that
so
attic
much,
is amazing from you guys. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, there's just so many people, like I could go on and on, like Phil Sanders, met him through Acquaint. He lives right in my neighborhood.
Three pennies.
Yep, Three Pennies. Just so many. I mean, like, even like just people that you're like, that's like my new really good friend, which is super awesome. Like, I know Nia Baker is listening right now.
Yeah,
and she's
just
been an amazing friend to me. And just like, we met up at Dr. Bombay's tea shop. And like, just from there on out, it's like, you're good people.
Yeah.
Like, let's hang out, you know? So there's been... Atlanta has just like loved on me fiercely.
Yeah.
I mean, Aaron Chuning, even though, you know, there's that funniness. But in all seriousness, like... I respect the work that he does so much.
Yeah.
He's so creative, and what he does for the Braves is just to be in awe of. And so really, like, really respect his work, really creeped hard on his work.
And we probably should stop because he's going to go. His head's already too big.
Yeah.
So listen, kudos to you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Whatever we can do to help, definitely come back before the book launches.
Definitely. Let's do it.
We'll do some giveaways and stuff like that on the air. So Kevin, I think we've gone long, but it was great.
It was a great show. I think it's one of your best.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this is Kevin Finn for Van Baird. Our guest today, Hannah Brincher, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you next week on Emerging Enterprise.